Hey, it's Agrita Dandrao, and you're listening to the Mindful of Everything podcast, which calls for the radical healing of the self and community that can allow us to outgrow cultures of scarcity and hyper-individualism, so that we can move to more caring and regenerative ways of living and working in community. This month, we invite to the space Manorag of Great, the artistic alias of Radhinka Ustasia, a multidisciplinary artist from the Caribbean island of Bonaire.
But if I see back, we actually do use art in that development work, especially if you're talking about going to places where people don't necessarily speak the language that you speak, or they don't have a certain level of education to understand like written language in a certain way. We have to draw for them, we have to make things visual, so that already brings an element of art into the development work.
From 2010 to 2023, Manorag has lived, studied and worked in the Netherlands, with the highest qualification she obtained there being a Bachelor's of Science in International Development Management, majoring in Rural Development and Innovation at Van Hall Laurenstein in Velp. During her study program, she minored in art and creativity at work, and this is where she started an exploration of combining her competing passions. Hi, Manorag. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really love that you're here with us today.
Yeah, thank you for reaching out. And we managed to actually make an appointment for the recording.
Yeah, I mean, that's for absolutely any guest. You know, you kind of need to find a time which helps you align together. I'm just happy that we're here finally. I'm excited for today's episode. But before we do begin, I would love for you to join us in a breathing exercise we like to do at the beginning of every episode. I think it's a great grounding practice, but it also kind of helps us ease into that space, especially when we're going to be talking about so many things that are very sensitive to you as a guest, but also us as listeners and me as a host. So if you could join us with that, it'd be great.
Yes.
Okay, so to begin, we just want to close our eyes, help ourselves ease into the moment. So as with every episode, we take deep breaths towards the end of the practice, but I do want to remind you, keep taking those deep breaths throughout the practice, but also throughout the episode. I think it's a great way for us to remind ourselves of the importance of the body. And we should be doing that throughout the day, whenever we do remember. And I feel like this episode, but also this podcast, this space that we've co-created, provides us with the opportunity to sort of bring that attention back to ourselves. So we're going to first start off with being a bit more present in the space that is holding us. So shift your attention right now to the sounds in the room or whatever space you're in. Be a bit more aware of the energy, even to what thoughts and what feelings you had before tuning in this month's episode. Remind yourself that as you're being aware of your surroundings, of the space and of the moment that is holding you, as you prioritize yourself, that this is a radical form of resistance to the systems that are very head-centric, which don't want you to have these moments in the day where you prioritize yourself, where you tend to yourself. But also, this is a pure act of gratitude to yourself and to everything in your life that is helping you get to wherever you need to be. Now we're going to slowly bring the attention to our bodies. And one by one, we're going to help our bodies really relax and prepare ourselves for today's conversation. So let's focus on the neck and the head. We're going to take a few head circles, starting from the left, and then we'll go to the right. Okay, so we're going to go to the left. Really allow yourself to feel that stretch in your neck and take it slowly. But this is all about really bringing the attention to the neck, and then we're going to move down the body. Now we're going to go to the right. And now let's shift the attention to the back. Gradually stretch the back, sitting as upright as you can. Again, remembering that we are trying to stay within our comfort zone, but also slightly pushing ourselves. Really allow that stretch to come through. Now we're going to take some shoulder circles. So starting from the back, and then we will go to the front. So really push those shoulders up. Push them back. Then allow them to drop. Really making those circles as big as possible. I hope you can feel that in your back and your shoulders. Really allowing for that stretch. Okay, now we're going to move forward. So take those circles forward. Let's bring the attention to the stomach. Oftentimes our stomachs are, you know, in a very sort of tense, tight state. Throughout the day, we don't really pay attention to that. Place your hand or both hands on your tummy. And as you're taking those deep breaths, allow your stomach to relax. Really allow those muscles to relax. And I'm sure you can feel that as we're doing that together. So now focusing on your hands and your arms, really allow those as well to relax. Wiggle your fingers as well a bit, stretch them out. Whatever helps to really relax your arms and your hands. And we're going to do the same for your legs and your feet. Really feel them relaxing. Okay, and you can move your feet around a bit, your toes. Really unlock them from any uncomfortable position they're in, if they are. Soften your knees as well. Make sure your legs are not tensed. Now, if you feel that you're ready for the exercise, we're going to go straight into it. We're going to take 5 deep breaths together. Again, you can extend that for yourself. Feel free to pause to do that. So we're going to take the first deep breath. Take a deep breath in. And a deep breath out. Take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. Take a deep breath in and a deep breath out. Deep breath in. And deep breath out. Final one, take a deep breath in. And a deep breath out. Now in your own time, and when you feel ready to do so, gently open your eyes. Thank you so much, Manorak, for joining us in that. I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, it is. I noticed, like, I was very, not that I'm not excited now about the interview. I was, like, jumping excited before.
Yeah, I mean, I have had guests telling me that they kind of felt a bit sleepy, not in a way that they were bored or anything, but it's like their nervous system calming down. And
yeah,
that's the whole intention behind the practice. So I'm very happy that you connected to that.
I always feel the yawning I always get when I'm stretching. Even if I'm like stretching to dance, I always get the yawning. So it this was like, even though I was in the chair, I still felt like stretching. Essentially did a lot of things I would do if I was stretching to dance. And yeah, I learned something about myself in those, what was it, 5 to 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Is that as soon as you kind of, because you kind of explain what you were going to do and then you actually start after. But as soon as you start explaining what we're going to do, I start doing it.
Really?
So I have some fun things when you're editing. You see.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, you have all that experience of, you know, bringing the attention to the body. And so it's good that you're taking that, I guess, initiative to like begin and like get a few more in as well. That's good. Yeah, I mean, I do that as well. I really do that as well. But obviously, because I'm hosting, then I can't do that. But thanks for that. I'm super excited now for the episode. I'm sure the listeners can hear just how much energy and enthusiasm you have. But I think to begin, it would be amazing if you could just talk a bit about how you sort of started seeing the connections with art and activism work, which I feel like for you, you're a very multidimensional, multi-passionate person, of course. But I think those two are, I think, your key areas of work. So how did you begin to see that connection, whether it was in your personal life or your professional, a bit of both?
I think for me, the journey has been, I mean, let's say I picked up little bits of it that people were kind of using art to make like political sense and these mm-hmm. things. But the connection for me to make that my work was really out of necessity, in a sense that there's a part of me that wants to do good for the, you know, greater good and community. And that's the part of me that went and studied development work. And then there's a part of me that just wants to art, you know. I just, it's like, if it's up to me, I would really just like shut down. If it's up to that side of me, I would just shut down everything and just go into a bunker and art and not worry about what's happening.
Yeah.
Right. So that, the part that wants to do good and wants to, that studied development work, at a certain point in my third year of studying development work, I felt depressed because I wasn't giving that other side of me that wants to art that much attention, because of course it's mm-hmm. Intensive doing a bachelor course, that you have to things you want to hand in. So you don't really have that time anymore to really sit and do art like, or I didn't have as I used to. And then I got the opportunity to do my minor in creativity and art. And of course, I took that chance. Mm-hmm. By that time, I felt like sucked dry of any creativity. And that was in my whole academic journey. At that point, I was about 28 years old. I've been like in and out of school for quite a long time. That was the happiest 6 months of my academic.
Oh, amazing.
Because I just got to art and we got to make music and we did theater. I was so happy and excited. And then it came to a point where, because it was called art and creativity at work. So with the first half, we really got to just do art. And the other half, they asked us, well, bring that into the work that you do professionally. And I was like, oh, how do I combine this development work with art? And I started to play around with the idea of playful development work.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't because I had to go back to my course and like ask people what they feel. It wasn't that greatly received.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I made like a feedback form, and some people thought it was like some trend or something like that. And I said, you shouldn't just jump on trends. And that felt really, really negative. But if I see back, we actually do use art in that development work, especially if you're talking about going to places where people don't necessarily speak the language that you speak, or they don't have a certain level of education to understand like written language in a certain way. We have to draw for them. We have to make things visual. So that already brings an element of art into the development work.
Mm-hmm.
But really, to summarize that, it's been a journey of how do I combine these two sides of me of wanting to do something, because I'm an observer and I see a lot of things, and I want to also bring possibilities to change things and solve issues that we're facing. So how do I bring these essentially very different worlds, as you said? How do I bring these two together? And it's just been a journey that I'm still on, to be honest. And it's starting to get at like a tipping point where I can. Before, I was kind of hesitant to even explain it. And I didn't know if people would get what I'm talking about. And now I've reached a point, because I'm also kind of entrepreneurial and I want to work for myself. So I was like, okay, how do I put these two things in one business? Especially also thanks to you, after your message that you sent me. And I was like, I'm not the only one that sees like this thing. And it was refreshing, and it kind of lit something in me to explain better what it is that I do. And I summarized it as I do holistic development work, and I do inner world development, which would be the art and culture, and I do outer world development, which would be the things as like regional development, especially with like sustainability and like climate adaptation and these things.
Yeah, thank you so much, first of all, for giving us so much insight. And I love, you know, the term playful development work. That is amazing. And I oftentimes feel that, especially when we are talking about, you know, sort of macro level development and decision-making work, none of that involves creativity. None of that involves tapping into your inner child, or, you know, the sort of practices and rituals we had as children that were allowed, that often seen as childish.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's something that we need to continue on throughout our lives, you know, across the different stages. So I'm amazed, really, I truly am, at the work that you're doing. And that's exactly why I wanted to bring you onto the space, because I feel like this is a part of us that we're not tapping into enough. We often see that is just like a part of our personal lives. You know, we can't really see the bridge to bringing that into our professional lives as well. So it's amazing that you're doing that. So I just wanted to kind of go a bit deeper into that. I really, first of all, love how you were talking about accessibility, you know, and we are presenting things to people that do not speak our verbal language. It's very important that we make sure that the knowledge we're disseminating is accessible, right? And the different ways we can do that requires us to tap into creativity. It requires us to be guided by the forces of art, really. So I just want to ask you why you think it's so important that we invite fluidity and creativity and play into grassroots level work. And what playfulness and, you know, what play holds for you when we are talking about development work? What do you exactly mean by that? And how are you incorporating that into your work?
Yeah, so accessibility, I think it's important. I think it's also an element of like the colonialism and decolonizing, that you realize that not everyone would understand the things the way you understand them from your perspective, and not to try and force your perspective, which would be the colonial part of it.
Mm-hmm.
because that the whole development work thing has a history, especially if we're talking about, I studied in the Netherlands, and specifically that course did start from a very colonial course that was before, and it kind of like evolved it is now. But I do think it's important to keep that in the back of your mind. We shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there's also good that has come from that.
Yeah.
But it's also good to keep in mind that it should be accessible. When it comes to playfulness specifically, as you said, I think it's important that to kind of reignite that the childlike side of you. And I think what has happened, why we oftentimes don't bring that in, is because a lot of our inner child is like, I don't want to say damaged, that's the word that came to mind, but maybe in a sense damaged, traumatized, and that we couldn't wait to be an adult, and now we want to push everything that is perceived to be childlike out. For me, it's been important to, I don't want to say that my inner child wasn't traumatized, it was, but somehow I always kept a connection to it, and I'm at a point where we've healed, and I'm happy that I kept that connection, that I didn't kill her off. She always kept the voice, and I think it's important in creativity. And I think if we can heal our inner child and bring that back into our decision making, that we can solve a lot of things easily and playfully, as we did.
Like, yeah,
mm-hmm. You know, with the child brain, you see the world differently. And it helps you come up with ideas that maybe with your adult brain that has a lot of barriers would cut off. Yeah, I think it's important to like reignite play in people, and maybe a tangible example of it is like in facilitating processes and workshops. It's like one of my favorite things, like the facilitation tools that you can bring in. A lot of them actually kind of like reignite that child brain you have, like for example, role playing, that if you bring policymakers and let's say key stakeholders in one issue, you bring them together and you make them role play each other's role and think from each other's perspective. That's already me kind of like playful, because you're like pretending to be that other person and going into their mind and why would they not want to solve the issue like you would prefer it to be solved, for example. And then it forces you to see, oh, wait, it's not only my perspective that is important in this. Another thing, it's like you have some icebreakers, for example, that can also be very playful. One of my favorite ones is find a word that starts with the same letter as your name.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like for people to, because you're in a room essentially most of the time with people that don't know you, and they have to remember your name for that session or sessions to come. I'll now take back my birth name. I did like Radiant Radinka.
Yes.
That helps people to so it is kind of playful in that sense. So that's I guess why it's my favorite element of the whole development work, the way I was started, is that we got a lot of knowledge on facilitation of processes. And it can be a big process with different workshops and meetings and focus groups. Or it can be like one workshop, but we learn all of these little tools. And when I look back at the tools, it's an element of playfulness. And there's also like an element of art in it, because a lot of times we work with flip charts, and we kind of, we want information from people. And in order to get that information from them, you kind of like make it pretty.
Mm-hmm. And
it shows that you've put a lot of work. Usually not that much work, but you put some work into the flip chart, that it makes them want to write something on it and give you the information that you want. So I feel like all of these are elements of like playfulness in development work.
Yeah. Yeah. It was making me think about how when you're working at the grassroots, right, when you're working with communities, you have to retain their attention. And play, creativity, you know, arts, that is all about fixating the audience's attention, right? I mean, even this episode, just the way we sort of bring ourselves to the space and how we interact with it, how we interact with each other, it is all about bringing forward that knowledge, but in a very interesting and a very innovative way that brings and holds that attention, which is so important. I mean, that's how it gets into your head. Like, I love how you gave the example of the icebreaker. I am very, very bad at remembering people's names. I always, whenever I go to a new space, it's a new course or a job or whatever, and I'll ask, you know, whoever I'm talking to what their name is. I'll hear it and then it'll go out the other ear. It's so bad. I don't know what it is. Yeah. So if we had icebreakers where you'd remember that, oh, that person used this adjective to describe themselves, it makes it so much easier. But it's because you really tapped into that skill of holding that person's attention. And I think art and play really encourages that. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, because that's something that I actually didn't pay attention to. Again, attention, it's all about attention and intention and why you want to capture the audience's, you know, attention, why you need that. And when you are working at the grassroots level and you are, you know, working on changing behaviors, it's very intimate and very deep level work. You do need to show these different possibilities to people. And for that, you have to get their attention. Yeah. Art has so much to do with that. We don't give it enough credit.
No, it's true. Yeah, it is very important to keep people's attention. And as you said, I think especially when you're talking about changing someone's behavior, even changing their perspective in a way to incorporate someone else's perspective, I think we are much more open to that as children. So I think that's maybe that element of catching that inner child and then kind of going through all of those the walls and filters that we put up as adults to go like, hey, maybe you look at it this way. So yeah, I think that's important. And I think that's why it's important to that we should heal our inner child and cultivate it and not shun it, shame other people. That I get that sometimes, that some people in my private life, I can sit and watch, I love cartoons, for example, I like to make things practical examples. I love cartoons. Usually I watch the adult cartoons, though, so I have to keep reminding my mom, like, it's really not for children. Like, I'm South Park or something like that. But sometimes I can watch like a children's movie or something like this. But then I've had people in my life who are like, oh, but it's like for children. And I'm like, oh, sorry, adult. <You're> like, what?
Yeah.
Why can you not? What is this? So it intrigues me. These people that are so bound on it must be dull and it's children. But I won't even drink like Capri Sun.
No way.
Like, maybe you don't drink it because you don't find it healthy. I understand that better than if you tell me.
Yeah.
It's children's juice. I'm like, okay.
It's like the people who judge you for going into the playgrounds.
Yeah.
I understand, of course, if they're like swings and other kids want to go on it, then you give them priority. But if it's empty and like, I want to go, I don't understand where the judgment comes from. But I see that a lot. Like, what's an adult doing on there?
It intrigues me because it's the same as people that get uncomfortable with my emotions intrigue me. Because a lot of times that things that I'm triggering something in them that they don't want to see.
Yeah.
That they don't want to give attention to. So that kind of thing. I made a quote some time ago on my social media that said, I didn't realize how strong I was until my crying made people pretending to be strong uncomfortable.
The act of being vulnerable is something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. So if you are happy to be vulnerable, so crying is a very vulnerable act. It is. It at that point, you're very vulnerable. So if you're able to come over yeah. your instincts as a mammal, as a human being, and be vulnerable in front of people who perhaps won't respect that, you know, the act of being vulnerable and that decision of yours to be vulnerable, because you've prioritized yourself in that. If you needed that release, you needed that. And if you needed that then and there, you needed that, right? A lot of people find that very uncomfortable. You know, they think, why is she crying? You know, why is yeah. she ruining the mood? Why is she?
Yeah, like, how dare you have tears?
Or how dare you show that in public yeah. or in front of how many people? Even if it's in front of one person who is just not in touch with their emotions, who doesn't practice how to be vulnerable and the importance of that. It is very challenging, but I think, again, like I say, embodiment is an act of resistance, is the purest act of resistance to these systems that are constantly telling us to just not follow your heart, to not be in touch with your body and your emotions and your mind, to kind of just be very robotic, very emotionless, senseless in what we do. And everything needs to just be about us as the individual. As an individual connected to the wider community, to the ecosystem. Yeah. So it's an amazing act of resistance to choose to be vulnerable because you're prioritizing your needs. Yeah. And I wish people were more comfortable with that.
I think the more before it would bother me because I don't want to make people feel like that version of me didn't want to make them feel angry, actually, because I would see the anger. And I didn't realize they were uncomfortable because yeah. they were kind of hiding that part of themselves. And the more I realized that that's what it was, the more I enjoyed making them uncomfortable. It's kind of a guilty pleasure.
No, I have that too. I have that too.
Yeah.
I mean, if I can just be myself and make someone feel uncomfortable within when they're in my presence. Yeah. That's a very thrilling experience. I mean, you're just being yourself. It's not like I'm going on my way to make someone feel uncomfortable or to challenge someone's ego. It's a great feeling.
I even have that with my hair, if you can imagine, because I have what's perceived to be bad hair in some communities and a lot of like communities that have an element of anti-blackness. Mm. And that's even in my own community. I sometimes joke because we have this legacy of the lighter you are, the kind of straighter your curls in your hair, the better you are as a person, I guess. I don't know. So I make a joke that, because obviously I'm very light skin, so I make a joke that my skin is good, but my hair is bad. my hair would be considered like 4C. And there was this boom in like the Black women's community where we started going natural, as they call it. That's a lot of the us before that, the norm was to straighten your hair chemically, which is very dangerous. There's even the hairstyler here died because she was inhaling this fume like on a daily basis. So, and it took a while for me to love my hair the way it is, but it's an example of one of the things right now that make people so uncomfortable, because even if people choose to be natural, they're doing all types of things to activate their curls and make it the curls more looser, so it's not this kinky coily hair that I have. So yeah, it took a while for me to, and it took people that had like super straight hair that were trying to get dreads tell me that they were jealous of my hair, because my hair naturally, if I just leave my hair without combing, it would just start blocking by itself. Like it took people that had essentially the perfect hair telling me that they were jealous of my hair, which I don't hear a lot.
to
be this comfortable and to be like, well, I'm just gonna make other people uncomfortable now with my comfortability with my hair. It's kind of being vulnerable in a society that tells you that hair is bad. So yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for actually sharing that. I really like how you always embed your lived experiences and, you know, you give those practical examples. I love that. I absolutely love that. And I feel like that is what sustains community work and grassroots work and activism, really embedding your lived experiences, because I think that's the best form of evidence, right? We talk about evidence-based work and policy work. This is your evidence right here, lived experiences, you know, people's personal experiences, how they experience things like racism and white supremacy, patriarchy.
Yeah.
You have to talk to the people. You have to really understand their stories. You have to give them that space to share their stories and then inform your work based on that. So I really, really love how you, you know, you're doing that and you're practicing that in the space in this episode. And, you know, the listeners can hear that and hopefully be inspired.
Yeah, I do try. I do like giving practical examples because I can use a lot of like big words and, you know, we have like the industry jargon. I can use all of that, but what I find a lot of times at moments that I do that, some people are like, what are you talking about? So yeah, I prefer to, sometimes I mix it up. I can use the jargon and then give the practical example of what that is, because it comes back to the accessibility. Yeah, that people should understand what you're talking about and what is all of these fancy words if people don't know what you're talking about. And yeah, where you're coming from and why that's important to you. And that's the feedback that I got from like Création, is that I was trying to really explain it in industry jargons. And I was a part of this group called Marketing for Hippies. And they would give me feedback on my writing. And someone said, explain to me in language that I would understand. Yes, I'm not getting what you're talking about. And he was like, talk more about your life as an island girl and why that's important to you. Why is climate important to you? I'm trying to incorporate that more, especially if to answer that question, if you want to hear it. Why is climate change important to me? A practical example would be that I have this wonderful house that I moved back to my island to help my parents renovate. But the thing with the house is that it's in the danger zone for when there's going to be seawater rising. So there was a report it was commissioned by Greenpeace, the Netherlands, and I think it was the University of Amsterdam did the research, and it said, well, there's the different planetary warming points. There's like, if it rises above this degree, this is going to happen. Yeah, the Celsius or whatever. Yeah, they give like different, if it rises above 1 point something degree, then this is going to happen. And, you know, this is the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And there is like the worst case scenario that in this area of Bonaire, where I live, is going to be permanently flooded by seawater. And mind you, we already know there's a flooding issue, but this is when it rains. We already know we're at a point where if it rains, there's probability for flooding. But that new knowledge that not only rainwater can flood us, but like the rising sea level can flood it. Yeah, that's another thing that we have to kind of come to terms with, and has pushed me to. And I was like in the middle of my artistry, it pushed me back into the development work. That's why I said it was a necessity, in a sense that I love my art, but what is my art if my house is flooded?
Exactly.
How is my island and other people are also affected on it? And what is having studied and having sitting with a network and with the knowledge to kind of help solve them. I'm not saying that I can be the superhero and solve everything, because it's not only up to me, of course, but I have the network and I have the knowledge to do something about it. And what is having that network and having that knowledge to do something about it if I'm just gonna sit and paint and you know, just forget about what's happening? So it reached a point where I couldn't do that anymore. And then I had to start to more tangibly, like, connect to. So, yeah, it I tried to ignore it, and it came back to me, and I was like, okay, I obviously cannot do one or the other, because if I only do development work, I'll get depressed, because I don't cultivate my creativity. And I obviously love astrology, because I mentioned it once before, but I went to an astrologist, and she said, you have way too much creative energy not to do anything. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's literally not good for you not to do anything creative. it would manifest in destructive ways. Like, I would find destructive ways to create mm-hmm. something destructive if I'm not purposely putting it into something positively creative. So yeah, that again, that necessity of one side having the knowledge and network and everything to do something about things like climate change and poverty and these mm-hmm. things, and the other side having this much creativity to stand still. And so I had no other choice than to combine the two in order to keep both of those sides content.
mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, we'd love to hear a bit more about your creation initiative. Mm-hmm. Because I really think that it provides a space and a platform for putting that knowledge into practice. There's a really big issue on information overload in the activism community, where there's a lot of knowledge being produced from different sources. And I guess it feels good to tap into those different knowledge bases and, you know, use all these big words and concepts and what you call sort of industrial jargon. How are we putting that into practice? And that is often not talked about enough. And I feel like the initiative, the Creation Initiative, is yeah. really providing that space to put that into practice. So we'd love to hear a little bit more about it, perhaps where you envision it to be in a few years,
yeah.
or if you're seeing that kind of shift into something else, transform into something else, we'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. So I shifted a couple of times, to be honest. Because it started out with this kind of vague idea to have an academy
mm-hmm.
for artivism. And that means that we would be using art, film, books, exhibitions, what have you, to bring attention to these global issues. And first I called it the anomaly, because it was so vague for myself. And then it kind of evolves into Duna community, and I Duna in my language, Papinintu, means to give, and in the, I don't want to say it wrong, but I think it's the Garifuna language, which is a community of enslaved people that moved to South America. Duna means water, and it was perfect because water gives life. So it was like a play wanted to give life to like a new way of coexisting. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed some confusion when I was talking about it with other people, and then, you know, you get that real time feedback. And I was like, I think the name is not there yet. And I continued, and I was like, okay, Kreashum, which means creation, in my language again, Papiamentu, because I try to give a nod back to where I come from. And, call it Kreashum. Because of that creating, so the creating a new way of coexistence stuck. And I was like, okay, how are we going to do that? Because creating a new way of coexistence between people, so ourselves, the community, and between our environment and nature, how do we do that? And I was like, okay, there's an element of awareness that has to be brought. But when I look at, as you said, in terms of awareness, there's a lot of organizations doing awareness. You have Amnesty International, you have Greenpeace, you have Slow Factory, which is one of my favorites. So you have like a lot of these places bringing awareness. And mm-hmm. I, from experience, know that, of course, if you have zero awareness, it's great once you start getting the awareness, but you will get to a point where you are aware. And what do you do with this awareness? And if you don't have a space like myself, but if you don't have something to pour it in, that awareness, that you can actively do something with that awareness that makes you feel purposeful, then you will get depressed. Because mm-hmm. I've been there. I've been aware and depressed because I'm like, what are you going to do now? So I was like, okay. Then once you're at that point, you want to do something about it. And from my knowledge, the way to do something about it, you need to know things like project management. You need to know how to facilitate processes, but you also need to have knowledge. So you're aware of all of these issues, but you need to also be aware of how all of these issues influence each other and how to come up with solutions that would tackle different elements from like the social, environmental, economic issues. So it goes a bit beyond just aware. It's more like knowledge of the systems, how the different elements like social, environmental, economic influence each other. And most importantly, what can you do about it? And give you the skills to do something about it. And my vision is now I'm setting up like the e-academy, like the online academy. And my vision is to have a physical hub in Bonaire. I would hope that I can set up more hubs globally, but I have to do one right first. So I want to start in Bonaire. And so you have the site where, let's say, anyone around the world, if they want that knowledge, they can sign up for a small fee. We do have to pay things. But I want to keep it, again, accessible. So you can sign up for a small fee and get that knowledge of like how to do research, how to be a facilitator, how does these different things influence each other. And then you, both the people online as people part of the physical hub that will get like physical training and process facilitation, would be part of a community, the creation community. And that community, I want to essentially have jobs for them in organizations or like the government or whoever's in need or interested in working with us that need facilitators, that they can go, hey, I need a facilitator for this project. And then I can help these people that have gone through this training also find work, a purposeful work in this area. And on the other hand, I want to have our own funds available that, let's say, two of my facilitators say, hey, we have this idea and we want to work together on it, that I can at least finance their startup, that they can get things going. So that is my vision for that. So, yeah, helping organizations that are vital into bringing this change have the people power to bring this change. And on the other hand, I know like there's going to be some facilitators that go like, no, I want to do the project myself. And
yeah,
I want to be there for them to help them also be able to bring that project to life.
Mm-hmm. So kind of pooling together the resources and like the funds necessary to facilitate the projects.
Yeah.
And it's all about relationship building as well. So you have all these organizations that have all of this knowledge and resources and tools, but it's about building those relationships between them so that you can increase the impact.
Yeah, exactly. It's about increasing the impact, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I really wish you all the best for that.
Thank you.
I can already see it's going to be, like, I can already envision it to be something amazing. And to have really big impact. And I love that you're bringing your personal values into the work and you're centering it. Everything you've talked about, accessibility, decolonizing your approaches, bringing that creativity and that play into the work, you really center that in the initiative. And yeah, that's really, really inspiring.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I just had to sort of wrap up the episode. I had one more thing to ask you. And that is about how you have used art, whether it's in creation or whether it's in any of the work that you've done so far, in really balancing that energy. Because like we have talked about in this episode and even before, there is so much that comes into the space. Yes, that can be very draining for us, but it can also feel quite overwhelming. Right, because you have all these different aspects of life coming together, because this work is very interdisciplinary. It's very interconnected with so many other bodies of work. So I think it'd be lovely if we could kind of end the episode and just talking a bit about how you bring that balance back to yourself, you know, as you are within the work, because I feel like art is really all about synergy. It's all about balance. But sometimes practicing that can be quite difficult within the systems of our bodies. So it would be amazing if you could give us a little insight and a little advice.
Sure. So for me, like when it comes to personally balancing my inner world, if I'm feeling overwhelmed, I sometimes just kind of draw, doodle, and just like clearing. It's kind of meditative. That I just grab a canvas and paint, and I'm like doing whatever comes out, just to clear my mind. And another way of balancing has been dancing, especially if I have like energy that has to like be burst out, like a burst of energy, that I dance.
Yeah.
And another thing that has helped me balance is to create something with whatever story is kind of like overwhelming me. The first project I did as Banarak was to write a story about my own situation that I was in that moment. That was very overwhelming. So that was my first book, A Tale of Her. And I wrote like a snapshot of a period in my life, from breakup to like healing from the breakup, and kind of like relating things that happened back to my childhood traumas. Mm-hmm. And almost a love letter to myself. Like when I feel down and I feel like maybe not worthy or whatever, I go back and read parts of A Tale of Hers. It's like, people that read it.
Right, therapeutic.
Yeah, people that read it feel, I don't know, also kind of therapeutic. And I get like, they write back very personal stories back to me. Like they tell me about their life. Like,
oh, so sweet.
That has been the most unexpected result of A Tale of Her. Not a lot of people have read it, but the people that have read it, I get like some kind of feedback back. Like I recognize myself at this part and blah, 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 right? Like, I get like almost a book back about their life, which is very lovely to get that privilege to get to know your readers personally. And that was that part. And then there's the part of like the overwhelmed with climate change. And I did a course to become a climate coach.
Mm.
And what a climate coach does is it's an initiative that started in, I think, the UK, the Carbon Conversations. And you have the Dutch version, Klimaatgesprekken. And they teach you, it was very intense. It was 3 days of the coach training. One day you get to see what the workshops look like. The other day you get like climate psychology, just very intense. And it's about how do we actually change our behavior? Because we know, for example, that flying is causing a lot of pollution, but we just want to make that trip to wherever because, you know, it's been our dream or get away from, you know, we always come up with some kind of excuse not to make to change. And so it's really about that, but then you have to look at your own issues. And I was freaking out because I was about to move to Bonaire. There's basically very other little way to get off the island than flying. So I'm like, you know, you start feeling guilty that I would have to fly in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, then it creates a lot of panic. And I started noticing the panic in my immediate movement. My feet has been cross and it's starting to crap. Sorry. But I started noticing like my immediate environment, like my friends were saying, like, yeah, they noticed like the weather is changing, but I can't shower shorter. You know,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
That kind of thing. So and I have my own opinion. Of course, we have something to do about it as individuals and the choices we make to bring climate change, but I think that if the industry that is the biggest prohibitor. Do not change. Then, it's not to make an excuse because we should also change, definitely. But if the industry don't change, then any little 1 minute shorter than we shower is not going to help, because they individually can cause climate change. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, of course.
Absolutely.
Mindful of the water you waste, but if the meat industry is just like leaving the the faucet on, if a Coca-Cola is just growing and depleting rivers to make Coca-Cola, then what's the point of my 1 minute shower shorter? So it's a double-edged sword. And I was noticing this panic within people, within myself, and it led me to write my second book with Centella. Centella, I wrote it S-E-N-T-E with like a strong, what you call it, that accent, and A. And I'm papiamentified it because there's something like papiament as a dialect that we take words from other languages and we make it in our own writing. And Centella, C-E-N-T-E-L-L-A in Spanish means a spark. So I took it as the main character in my book, which is named Centella, to kind of play with a spark of hope. I call it the subtitle of the book, Amidst Uncertainty. And Centella is, so she's talking to us from the future. And she's telling us like the state of climate change, but also tangible actions that we should essentially start doing now to kind of remedy, because the climate is, the weather is changing, and we can also argue that it's a natural phenomenon that climate changes, but the issue now is that we have kind of make it happen more rapidly and more intensive by our activities. And so she's talking back about, she's talking about her mom that's a lawyer that's been fighting these corporations and industries that are making it a lot worse. And she's talking about her own actions and her own activities that she has taken. And it's kind of like a blueprint of also what I want to do with Reaction, to have a community of people that can tangibly make changes. So that's a way, again, a practical example of how I use my own panic sometimes, my own pain experiences to tell a story through art that can hopefully inspire people. But a lot of times it's to kind of like regulate my own panic.
Yeah, but it's inspired me, it's deeply inspired me, and I know that it's deeply going to inspire the listeners and wherever this conversation goes into the world, wherever it's going. But yeah, thank you so much, Manarak, for coming on to the podcast and for sharing your experiences, your wisdom, and for giving us a really lovely framework on how you can actually embed lived experiences into your work. I feel like through the episode, we've given so many different examples and how they connect back to the work and how they can really, bring about this change that we need in community and within ourselves. So thank you so much for the amazing work you're doing. And again, congratulations for Creation itself. And I'm very excited to hear about, the next steps, its progress. So do keep us informed about that. And I'll also let the community know through like social media posts and through the website. But yeah, thank you so much for coming here and for connecting with us and for being vulnerable actually in this space.
Thank you for having me. I had a blast and I really enjoyed the breathing exercise. Thank you for reaching out.
Thank you.
Good luck also with everything you're doing with the podcast.
Thank you.
Definitely keeping up with everything you're doing as well.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful of Everything podcast. To stay updated for the recent releases for the show and to connect with inspiring guests like Manarak, subscribe to the podcast and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook. Don't forget to give a rating on iTunes so that the show can reach other wonderful humans like you who also enjoy engaging in the conversations held in this space. To find out more about Manarak's work and to access full episode resources, visit mindfuloveverything.com. Thank you once again for being a part of the Mindful of Everything community. and for engaging in disruptive thinking and radical healing. I look forward to seeing you all here again next month. Till then, stay safe, healthy, and joyful always.